I thank the organizers, and I believe that it is really important that we discuss these issues to possibly gain common understanding of the aspects of the issue, and then, of course, building solidarity to work together going to the future. So I'll be speaking, as Benita mentioned, on coloniality, extractivism, and solidarity and resistance. I will share slides so that we can all flow together, and probably the issues I'm presenting, pictures sometimes speak louder than words, and I can say fewer things than having to give long talks. Right on the cover of the cover slide, you have a photograph from a part of the Niger. This photograph was taken at a place called Goi in Ogoni, Ogoni land of the Niger Delta. It suffered multiple oil spills from 2004 thereabout, and there's been no serious cleanup effort. So the community is displaced and totally contaminated. And that to me is a kind of, it's a metaphor for extractivism in this part of the world. And doesn't this speak about coloniality and whatever would allow that kind of harm to be done to the environment? And now just to begin, I'll refer us to the many statements made by Thomas Sankara, former president of Burkina Faso, who was assassinated and removed from office by that means. He was a true Pan-Africanist, was very clear about environmental justice and gender justice. He said, imperialism is a system of exploitation that occurs not only in a brutal form of those who come with guns to conquer territory. Imperialism often occurs in more subtle forms, a loan, food aid, and blackmail. Now, this is extremely important to consider what he said here, because there are many ways of exploitation, many ways of carrying out destructive activities without any sense of responsibility. And this can be through co-option or through other means of exploitation. And now, the level of degradation that has gone on and very harmful exploitation that has gone on so far around the world is more or less encouraged by the spoken and unspoken unjust international division of labor, where some parts of the world are seen as sacrifice zones and others can just be exploited without any kind of accountability. And this is also the extreme degradation that we see around has been promoted by colonialism, cheap labor, cheap natural resources, exploitative markets, militarized extraction, because you cannot keep on just getting things cheaply and externalizing all the costs without reaction. The only way you can do this is by cohesion and by militarization. And we've seen this happen even today in different parts of the world where wars are being waged over access to natural or resources or the gifts of nature. And so the capitalist system pushes on. Now, the first president of Ghana said something very profound in one of his books talking about imperialism. He said the worst form of imperialism is exploitation without responsibility. That's what he said. And the photo you have right there on the screen shows this infamous guy who colonized and who had businesses that were extremely destructive in the then Belgian Congo. And he could bestride Africa from Cairo to Cape Town in kind of very inhuman forms of exploitation, which was possible also through forced labor and through all kinds of very, very terrible means of modes of exploitation. And this has been generally enforced through marginalizing the population, those who live in the areas, excluding them from discussions, from political conversations, excluding them from being on the table to discuss about how resources are appropriated or extracted and made up and transformed from their communities and territories. And we can say in one word that this has been extremely racist, and we still have environmental racism even as we speak. Without going to a definition, I believe you all know the definition of the terms covered in this topic that we're having today: coloniality, extractivism, solidarity, and resistance. But let's just remind ourselves that coloniality is basically, in a very simple form, the mentality by which colonialism sustains itself, despite nations and territories having haven't had flagged independence. I'm sure we can all relate to this. I'm speaking to you from a location that is not far from where the first oil well was drilled in the Niger Delta in 1956, and from where commercial export of crude oil began 2 years later. And that oil pit today is a monument to the oil industry in Nigeria, and to me is the number one scene, crime scene, extractivist crime scene. And that's what it is, reminding people about what extractivism does and who powers and who allows extractivism to go on the way it's been going on. Since speaking about the crime scene, it might be interesting for us to just reflect at the amount of ecological harm or oil spills that accompany the extraction of crude oil. This may not be uniformly across the world, but in many places, whether in the Sucumbio or Amazonian Ecuador, or in the Sudetes in South Sudan, the Niger Delta in Nigeria, and even in new oil find territories, you have massive oil spills because the pipelines can convey the oil can exceed their lifespan, which often is between 20 to 30 years. And when oil pipelines are served under high pressure beyond the lifespan, of course, they readily give up and release tons of crude oil into the environment, causing all kinds of harms, all kinds of cancers, all kinds of skin diseases, and all kinds of birth defects and what have you. Just to underscore this fact, in Niger Delta, within a period of 2 years, 2018 to 2019, there were 1,300 oil spills recorded, coming to about 5 oil spills every day. Another crime that accompanies colonial extraction, when I say colonial extraction, I'm talking about extraction that continues with the same mentality that happened in the colonial times. Extraction that only looks at getting raw materials for export to the metropoles, export for transformation elsewhere, and then import of the finished product to in just for the basic purpose of enriching transnational corporations. And I should just say here that before colonialism, territories that were eventually colonized were administered by transnational corporations. And it appears that it was when it became uneconomical for them, and when they didn't have sufficient gun power, they didn't have the military, sufficient numbers of military, save a few mercenaries working with them to suppress peoples in the territories, they handed over the territories to the colonial and imperial forces. And so right now, after independence, many of the governments we have in the new colonial states are still operating on behalf of transnational corporations. And that is why you could have gas flares, gas furnaces, that like the one on this slide, going on in the Niger Delta for decades without stopping. And these are gases coming out of oil wells associated with oil production, and they're being burnt with millions of tons of carbon greenhouse gases being released from this into the atmosphere, and billions of US dollars wasted every single year. This is going on with regard to crude oil extraction, but the same can be said for coal extraction, to fracking, and to other destructivist extractivist activities. Now, when you think about the major global response to environmental crisis today, you think of climate change. And the most celebrated agreement made in this direction is the Paris Agreement of 2015. And now the Paris Agreement has been celebrated as one agreement that is agreed generally adopted by governments across board in the world, recognizing the fact that global warming is a serious problem. And that to me is the most significant praise that we can give to the Paris Agreement, that everybody more or less agreed that something needs to be done. But beyond that, we don't see anything serious on the table for action to be taken. Because again, coloniality is a major force. The governments are still thinking of exploiting territories without accountability, transforming nature without caring what is what the end result would be, thinking in short term, with thinking 4-year format, not thinking about children and grandchildren and next generations. And this is what the kind of consideration that the Paris Agreement has not given to the crisis. And as I'm saying this because the major aspect of the agreement in terms of implementation is the nationally determined contributions. Now, when you allow nations to determine what is convenient for them to do in terms of emissions reduction, then of course you are moving on a blind debt. You are going a way that you cannot really say on the aggregate, if this is done according to science, this is what the result would be. Because nations would only do what is convenient. And that is why in the past administration of the United States, the president could say, I'm walking away from this agreement. What can you do about it? And now the new administration, we are going back to the agreement. But that basically doesn't really change the mechanisms about what is going to be done. The major discussion we're having now, both from governments and from transnational corporations, take note of that. Government and transnational corporations, these guys are in bed together, some kind of matrimonial arrangement, connection. They talk about net zero. Net zero is a kind of escalation of carbon trading. In the sense that countries would say, this is what we're going to do. I mean, we know we are releasing this amount of carbon or greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, but this action will be taken somewhere else. Without stopping the action that releases the greenhouse gases, we're going to do something elsewhere that ameliorates or offsets the harm that we are creating. And to me, this is what really shows that market environmentalism is just a kind of harmful fiction that we should not even tolerate. Because this is what created the problem. It's still compounding the problem, and everybody's acquiescing to it and accepting that something's been done elsewhere to take care of the crimes committed elsewhere. So net zero is not zero. You talk about something being done here, another thing being done there, as if nature is run by mathematics or calculus, which we do know is not the case. Now, Malcolm X said, only a fool will let his enemy teach his children. And so permit my chuckling at that. If we see those who've been giving direction to policy multilateral spaces over the years, and we know what they're looking for, exploitation, they're looking for profit, that not care about the planet or the people, and then taking advice or directives from them is pure foolery. And we are not fools. Human beings are wise. We have the capacity to stand up for ourselves. And we should really be careful when we listen to some governments like those, that some politicians in Africa who are saying, Africa will develop whether the West likes it or not. And they said, boycotting oil and gas firms in Africa is a misguided course of action. And when you hear that, now you think about, so this is why oil must be extracted from Okavango in Namibia, in a very, very, very important biodiversity hotspot. We can just go there and damage everything, destroy nature, and because we want to have fuel to burn. The thinking that we can keep on replicating the present kind of mode of production and consumption, to me, is one of the most wrong-headed things that coloniality has ingrained in the brains of humans, and something that we need to cut ourselves from. We have to decolonize our minds in terms of concepts of production, concepts of consumption, as well as concepts of progress and growth. We have to really rethink, what does it mean to grow? What does it mean to develop? How do we contrast that with well, living well? How do we contrast that with things happening for the common good of the greater number of people and not just corporations? Now, just before I move forward, moving on with colonial mode of production, I just mentioned two ongoing projects in Africa at the moment. One is the East African crude oil pipeline that is expected to go from Uganda all the way to the coast in Tanzania. And then another one is the Nigeria-Morocco gas pipeline that is meant to extend the currently existing West African gas pipeline, which goes from Nigeria to Ghana so far. And now just take note of the fact that both pipelines, either the one in East Africa or the one in West Africa, they're all going to the export market. This is colonial political and economic arrangement. Nothing has changed. And so the colonial mentality is driving economy. And this is just the system that is not for, that does not necessarily bear anything good for people who are colonized or who are under neo-colonial arrangements. And happily, the South African gas pipeline has met a lot of resistance by local people. And so far, many of the financial institutions who were going to fund it have pulled out from it. But of course, the major players are still insisting in carrying out the activity right there. So the needs outside the colonial arrangements prioritizes the needs of the colonial forces or colonial, not the colonized, but the colonizer's interest. And we should take note of that. And right now we've got a situation where we should really question the whole idea of extractivism. Of what use? Have we not extracted enough? Do we need to continue with the current mode of energy production? Or do we need to question it, question energy itself? Should we have a new concept of energy? What do we need power for? What do we need energy for? Can we live in a different manner? Or can we continue to consume things with the same, the way that has brought us to the crisis point that we're in now, hoping for things to be better just because we can offset pollution one way or the other? We've extracted enough amount of minerals that could last and that could take the world into the far future in terms of recycling already mined minerals or using them in another way. Just think about something like gold. How much production is gold used in, apart from just storing them and claiming, assuming that there's monetary value in the mineral and just locking them up in vaults, in banks, and in other secure places? I believe that this is one of the things we need to think about when we think of continuing with extractivism. The Chinese proverb says, if you get into a problem in a hole, the best way to begin to get out of that problem is to stop digging. Why must we keep digging when we know that we cannot, for example, continue to burn the amount of fossil fuels that are already known to exist? And rather than stop expanding extractivism, we're seeing nations and corporations intensifying search for new oil fields, for new gas fields, and new coal deposits. That clearly shows that the climate fighting global warming remains purely fictional if the world continues to dig into the very activities that is creating compounding the problem. I mentioned about carbon offsetting, and just looking at this chart is a very simple chart, but really shows how that really works. The situation where it's agreed that a factory can pollute to a certain level, and some factories are not able to pollute as much as they are permitted to pollute. So they have a leftover allowance that they can sell. And then there are others who pollute more than they are permitted to pollute. So they can buy the space that is not utilized by the less polluting company and pay money for it. And so the one that's not polluting less gets paid. And the one that's polluting pays some money to clear its conscience. Does this make sense? It's just another way of turning reasoning upside down, permitting crimes to be committed just by mathematical formula and making money in the process. And with this kind of arrangement, we've seen direct carbon colonialism, where territories have been bought in the global south and elsewhere, and communities have been tricked into watching after carbon in forests and in trees, so that some corporation somewhere can keep on polluting. And one example was found in a forest arrangement in Eastern Africa, Southern Africa, in Mozambique to be specific, where communities and families were paid less than $100 to watch over trees, the carbon in trees for 90 years plus. And the subsection of the agreement was that even if those who signed the agreement died off, their children will continue watching the carbon for that kind of payment that they received. And that was pure carbon slavery, pure carbon colonialism, completely unacceptable. And so we have to decolonize. And decolonize is not just a political term, it's an economic term, it's a social reality that we need to engage about decolonizing our minds also and stop all the grab, the land grab, the sea grab, the sky grab, which is best as shown, illustrated in under the net zero arrangement. The net zero arrangement would allow for a lot of land grabbing. We allow for sky grabs through geoengineering. We allow for sea grab through geoengineering, and maybe even by some varieties of blue economic activities. And it's about the world at the moment believing that techno fixes can solve every kind of problem. And I believe that this is one thing that we need to wean ourselves away from. Yeah. So now I'm going to mentioned, this is a real solution. We talk about false solutions that drive carbon slavery and carbon colonialism. One solution has been proposed by All Watch International, and this was building up on the original arrangements of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, where nations were categorized into industrialized polluting nations and not industrialized nations, and next one and not next one countries. And All Watch proposed the creation of our next zero nations and territories, those who are not polluting at all, those who don't have anything to cut. They're not emitting much carbon, having greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, so they can't even find what to cut, although they're proposing they're going to cut something. So this proposal was that territories who have left resources, fossil resources in the ground, who has kept the carbon in the ground, who don't have to worry about carbon capture and storage, but leave it in the ground, they should be recognized as nations carrying out real climate action. And we have examples of territories that should already be qualified to be recognized to be carrying out real climate action, such as Ogoni people. Ogoni has kept their oil in the ground since 1993 when shale was expelled from that territory. We have nations like Costa Rica who has said we're not exploiting oil, fossil fuel oil in our territories. Belize has said no offshore oil drilling because fish is better than oil. Fish is more economically viable than oil. And so the responses that we need to draw up at this point going forward is that we really need system change, not as a cliche or something built from below. We need to have mental realignment away from coloniality. We have to decolonize ourselves, mobilize, be vigilant about the forces of colonialism, build solidarity across regions, global south, global north. We are really seeing forces that are working in the interests of humans and interests of the planet. And so we need to understand what is the problem? What are we really confronting? And I mentioned this in the course of this conversation. Environmental racism, neocolonialism, massive inequalities, as we've seen, even the COVID-19 vaccine issue, gender discrimination, ecocide, massive destruction of environment that cannot easily be recovered. So we need to decolonize even the stories that we tell, and we have to work to defend our communities, stop destructive extraction, support agriculture, for example, in a way that works in line with nature, and demand, of course, ecological debt. Yesterday, we were having a conversation on this issue, and a friend did say that ecological debt is not just something historical, not something about colonial debt, about sub-imperialist debt, about all the degradation and destruction that has gone on. It's something that is going on now. There's a debt that is being incurred in current destructive extraction, and that should be recognized and paid. One way of paying this, he said, was to totally wipe out all the debt, the odious debts that some nations are said to be owing. And then we should stand for resource democracy, which means recognizing the right of nature, rights of Mother Earth, and reconnecting ourselves to nature and knowing that we are part of nature and not apart from nature. Now, one of the inspiring leaders that we've had in Africa, Samora Machel, of blessed memory of Mozambique, said, we need international solidarity is not an act of charity. It's an act of unity between allies fighting on different terrains toward the same objective. The foremost of this objective is to aid the development of humanity to the highest level possible. To me, this clearly means we're going back to nature. I mean, respecting everyone, respecting other species, and knowing that we're all interdependent and not carrying out national xenophobia, as we're seeing in the coronavirus issue and other ways that discrimination has manifested. Angela Davis said that in terms of resistance and whatever we do, say optimism is a political act. So you have to act as if it were possible to radically transform the world, and you have to do it all the time. Che Guevara said we should be reasonable and demand the impossible. What you demand, Mandela said, it is impossible. It's always said to be impossible until it's achieved. So really, all these sayings that keep inspiring us means that there's no objective that is too high that we cannot achieve. So we can achieve it, we can decolonize ourselves, we can clearly stand away from colonial exploitation, we can very clearly end extractivism, unnecessary extractivism, we can say yes to life, no to mining, we can say no to false solutions, no to genetic engineering, no to extreme genetic engineering or extinction engineering. And really, as Martin Luther Jr. said, King Jr. said, there comes a time when silence is betrayal. The man that inspired me so much as an activist, Kensala Wiwa, who was executed by the Nigerian state in 1995, said, silence is treason. And this is why we must speak and speak very, very loudly. I thank you so much for paying attention to this presentation. And I hope I've managed to pass across some ideas with regard to what we started talking about, coloniality, extractivism, solidarity, and resistance. There's so much resistance on the ground, and I can tell you about that all day, but I do know that we have other things to do at this point in time. I thank you for your attention.